My name is Jan Barney Newman. I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Today's date is May 10th, 2014. I'm here because the theme of our stories today was introduced to me as telling about an item that you've had for many years and that is very valuable to you. The item I'm going to show you is something I've had since I graduated from high school, so in my last year of high school, but I've brought it with me every place I've moved since the late 50s, and I've only worn it once, but it's nevertheless very valuable to me, and I'll show it to you. And tell you why I got it. Can you see this? When I was in high school in a small town in Oklahoma, a town that was, it didn't really have an industry. It was a typical town in a rural area. If there was an industry, it was because it was there were Grainville elevators and things of that sort that wouldn't be unusual in a rural town. But there was also the government office for the Plains Indians. And so that's the environment I'm talking about. When I was in high school, a friend of mine, whose name was Topper, nickname was Topper, told me, he was the president, by the way, of the Future Farmers of America, FFA Club. And he said to me, I've nominated you to be the queen of FFA. And I said, well, that's very nice. I didn't know town girls could ever have that honor. And he said, well, you can't unless you raise an animal. And I said, great, I have a Cocker Spaniel. No, that's not what he meant. But he had a new batch of pigs, and if I would go with him every morning out to feed these pigs, the club would allow that I was raising an animal. So I was elected, and every morning at 5 o'clock, I'd sit on the curb in front of my house with my cup of coffee, wait for Topper to come by in his pickup, and then we would go out and feed the pigs, which basically was throwing, you know, feed into the pen where all these little pigs were running around. And over time, my pig and the other pigs grew up, and it was time to show them at the county fair. Well, that was an experience because we had to wash them off, which meant we put them in the back of a pickup, took them to what was a car wash then, which was backing the truck into a filling station, and then getting hoses and washing them in the pickup. And I'd never done that before, but it was kind of interesting. And then we went to the fairgrounds where we got the pigs ready to be shown. Well, I have to tell you, when you have pigs that are black and white, you take oil and you oil the black parts, and you take white shoe polish and you polish the white parts. And then you take a little switch and you learn how to hold them so that their good side, you have to learn which is the good side, is in front of the judge. So I was quite challenged by all this. And found it interesting and fun. And just as I was getting ready to go in to show my pig, all of a sudden the local FFA chapter realized that the other towns that were coming to the fair all had candidates for Miss Caddo County. And we didn't have one. And it turned out that Topper's mother had a beauty shop. And so she got me out of my pig pen to fix my hair so I could represent our town in the Miss Caddo County contest. In the meantime, I showed the pig, won a red ribbon, and was very happy. Then we took them to and I also became Miss Caddo County, which was another bonus. So here I've moved this jacket with me, all these places. And it's a wonderful, 1 minute, that's all I need. So it's a wonderful jacket, and in spite of the fact that it has a solid gold satin lining, it is totally reversible, and I could probably wear it to any roller derby I went to, I never wore it. But the Borders, Tom Borders, was having a 50s party, and Hack and I didn't know what to wear, so we went up to the attic, and here was this jacket that had been hanging there since I moved, all the places I moved. And okay, I'll wear that. And I think Hack wore some overalls or something. We didn't know what to wear. And it turned out, if you notice the name of the town I grew up in, that by this time, Anadarko was a very rich oil basin. It had just been discovered. And several guys at the party at the Borders came up to me and said, I invested there and I didn't get a jacket. So it had a relevance to being in Ann Arbor too. And so even though I haven't worn it, except on that occasion, I've kept it all these years, and why wouldn't I? It has wonderful memories, and I didn't have to invest to get this jacket.
My name is Dale Leslie, and I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and today's date is May 10th, 2014. I get more enjoyment telling my grandchildren that I was born in the last century. I suspect most of us in this room could also make that statement. And my son, just to show you never get any respect from your children, my son said, that's right, Dad, and not only that, you were born in the first half of the last century. So, really makes me feel good. But what I want to talk about is going back 60 years, back into the 1950s, back before television was prominent, back before certainly the internet or computers, and people sought entertainment, and one gentleman here in town, Ralph Peterson, an associate professor at Eastern Michigan University, would take equipment around to different rural communities during the summer and show motion pictures. Many of you may have seen these. I know my cousin, for instance, said he used to ride his bicycle up to one of the schoolyards to watch these features. And they were movies, all different types, westerns and romantic stories, cartoons, of course. And he would project these motion pictures onto a white sheet, literally a bed sheet, that he and his cohort would help spread over the back of a schoolhouse or perhaps some other building that would be nearby. So the bottom line is that this activity went on throughout the summer, and as I said, in over 25 different locations throughout the county. Now, he was assisted by his son, Dwayne Peterson, who still lives in town. You might recall Dwayne was assistant principal at Ann Arbor Pioneer High School, and he still plays golf, or says he does, at Ann Arbor Golf and Outing. But Dwayne was his dad's assistant, and he thought at the time it was a little bit of a challenge to go around and take all this equipment and set it up and take it down. But as he reflects back on that particular period of time and the closeness that he began to have with his father, it was pure enjoyment from his perspective now. How would he pay for the shows? Mr. Peterson would go around in these various communities, stopping at gas stations and convenience stores a week before the showing. And it was very rewarding to see how local merchants would support what Mr. Peterson was doing. So consequently, there was no charge to come to these motion pictures, motion picture presentations that Mr. Peterson and his son Dwayne presented. I have a picture of the Village Green out in Dixboro. Dixboro is a little hamlet about 2 miles east on Plymouth Road. And in the Village Green, there's a one-room brick schoolhouse. And sure enough, on the back of the schoolhouse, they would string this bed sheet and show these movies. This happened at many other places throughout Washtenaw County. So it's the type of thing that happened and people tend to forget about it. It also is a reflection on how much simpler things were back then. Now, what was the most popular show? Well, believe it or not, the kids liked the cartoons. That's probably no surprise. But he was able to show all different types of movies and tried to run them back to back so that everybody's curiosity was in place. And Duane recalls that sometimes the crickets nearby would make more noise than they were able to produce in turning the volume up on the motion picture. So sometimes the crickets drowned out the presentation. But again, it was just a wonderful thing that his father and Duane did for this community, and I wanted to make note of it here today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John Johnson. I'm in Ann Arbor. Today is May 10th, 2014. I'm going to talk about my journey through the world of the bicycle. First of all, this is a bicycle helmet. Absolutely wear a bicycle helmet if you're going to ride a bicycle. I have a friend who has much left of a brain because he didn't wear his helmet, and it's really important. That's the first thing I had to say. I started riding bikes back when I was a little kid, like everybody else. I remember my dad running along next to me and the chains jingling in his pocket as he was trying to keep me upright on my rugby bicycle. And then I graduated to a Schwinn Varsity. It was a 10-speed bicycle and weighed 45 pounds. It's incredible, but Schwinn guaranteed the frame for life. So, but then Nelson Wood down the block got a Louisian Bobet. He was some Tour de France champion, and this bike weighed so little. I couldn't believe how light it was, how easy it was to ride, and it was a big revelation to me that bicycle materials and design made a big difference. So eventually I became a bike mechanic, and I earned myself a Schwinn Paramount, which was the kind of bike that Schwinn used to make for Tour de France riders. And I loved that bike, but then a titanium bike came out. There was a company called Teledyne that made all kinds of aircraft parts, and they made a titanium frame that weighed even less than my Schwinn Paramount frame, and I just couldn't believe how light it was. I was down to 18 pounds for a bicycle. And but then, just like Mr. Toad, there's always something around the corner that's even better. So all of a sudden there was recumbent bicycles. Now you have a low aerodynamic drag, so maybe that's a better way to go faster and use materials. And then all of a sudden, handling was the way to go. I bought a Moulton made in England that has the most rigid frame you can buy. And then finally I asked myself, after about 10 years of riding the Moulton, why am I riding a bicycle? And all of a sudden I realized I was riding a bicycle for exercise. And here is an exercise machine on two wheels. This is called the Elliptigo, and it's got these pedals that go in an elliptical fashion, designed by some people out in the San Diego area. And it's heavy. It's the heaviest bike I own. It's the worst handling bike I own. And because you're standing upright, it's the least aerodynamic bike I own. But the others are all gathering dust, and this is the one I'm riding all the time. And it's slower, of course, but I really get a lot of exercise. When I first got it, I couldn't go around a block without getting out of breath. I could ride to Dexter and back, hour and some change, but on my regular bike, but on this bike, it took me a lot longer. So the result was that I kept riding this bike and kept riding it, and I got better and better, and finally I was up to 60-mile rides. And I said, you know, I'm going to take this bike on the hell of a ride. So that's the one big ride I do every year. It's 100 miles long. And so I knew I'd be the slowest bike on it, and certainly I was. And I made it about 60 miles, going down a hill, Mount Hope Road, just before the lunch stop, and I hit this pothole, and the trees were hiding with the leaves and the shadows and things like that. The bike went flying off to the left, and I went flying off to the right, and I landed hard on my right side. And in the hospital, they told me I cracked my pubic bone. And so I was hobbling out of the hospital on crutches, and I went and saw my doctor the next week, and he said, well, you're not going to be sitting on a bicycle seat for a while. Maybe you can rehab by something like maybe an elliptical machine or something like that. So I got just the ticket. Within a month, I was back on this thing and riding around. So in the year that I've been riding this, I mean, since high school, I've been gaining weight. I was up to about 175 pounds, and now I'm down to 155. Now, I've been riding bikes all the time, but it was when I started riding this thing and it made a big difference. So that's my story, and I love my bike.
Hello, I'm Larry Gray. I'm in Ann Arbor, and today's date is May 10th, 2014. Tomorrow's Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day, everybody out there who's a mother. I'm going to tell a little adventure story in hopefully 5 minutes, so Chuck, cut me off if I get more than 5 minutes. But I'm interested in family histories, but I decided to talk a little bit about something I did a few years ago. I turned 60 back in 2010. I was going on a mission project to Kenya, and I said, you know, why don't I climb Mount Kilimanjaro? I'm not that adventurous, but I've always kind of, you know, read a lot of adventure books, and I thought, this can't be that hard, even though I'm 60 at the time. So I searched the internet, I found a company in Tanzania, signed up, and went there about a week and a half before the mission trip, and got there, found out there were three people that signed up for this trip. So there was a gal from Australia, a guy from Virginia Beach, and me. 15 porters. We needed all these porters because we had to carry all the food and tents and even latrine. And I'm going to make this a little short because the first 3 days and nights were difficult, but not that difficult. You start around 10,000 feet. You're climbing, but it's a steady climb. You're not mountain climbing. But it started snowing, and we got quite a bit of snow. This is in February of 2011. So the plan was at about 3:30 in the morning on summit day, we were going to get up and go to the summit and hopefully see the sunrise up there and come back down. Well, my tent mate Joe was hurting. He's in mid-50s, knees were probably bad from football. So we started out, there were just five of us, the guide, the assistant guide, and us three. And Joe was struggling, very snowy, and he wanted to turn back. And the guide said, no, you can do it, which was a mistake because poor Joe could not do it. But we slowed our pace down, Joe was struggling, had to stop a lot. It got more difficult anyway. Finally, at about 10:30 in the morning, still had a long, long way to go, he said, you know, I've had it. I can't go any further. So he went back to the camp with the assistant guide, which left Kathy, me, and John, our guide, and we had the hardest climb left. And again, what happened was you get all these switchbacks climbing up a crater. It's so snowy, you can't see the trail. Finally, and at 2 o'clock, reached the lower summit. 4:30 in the afternoon, we made it to the summit, and I'm very proud of that. But the problem was it was 4:30 in the afternoon, and nobody else was up there. We had to climb all the way back down to our camp, and we knew it was going to get dark in about an hour and a half. John, our guide, said, you know, I called other people that are going to help us. They're going to come back and help us get down. We got to the point where they were supposed to be there. There was nobody there. So it was getting dark. We still had several hours to go. Finally, we're going down these switchbacks in the snow and the dark and see a couple of headlights and a couple of the guides that came up and helped us down. Got back at 10:30 at night. That was the longest day of my life, but you know, it was a great adventure, and I'm glad I did it. Thanks.
I'm Jesse Bernstein, and I'm proud to be at the Ann Arbor District Library's main branch. And today is May 10th, 2014. When I was born in Brooklyn, that's not Michigan, the other Brooklyn, if it had been a separate city, it would have been the fourth largest city in the United States. Yet there was no real identification for that location other than the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team. And as a youngster, as Ed Sullivan would say, the Dodgers were my life. They were the most important thing there was, more so than almost anything else. And it was a very different environment then because the players lived near Ebbets Field in downtown Brooklyn. And Jackie Robinson sold kitchen appliances in the off season. And you could walk into a grocery store and there'd be Gil Hodges buying a loaf of bread, or Pee Wee Reese getting some chewing gum or whatever. And I went to Gerstenhaber's toy store and bought a Duke Snyder signed autographed baseball bat, a Louisville Slugger, real wood, 33 inches long, and a ball has never touched this bat. It followed me from Brooklyn to Queens, to New Paltz, where I went to college, and then to Ann Arbor, and it's been with me all this time. I found myself 30 years later, after I bought the bat, at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles with my children. And we were sitting watching them play the St. Louis Cardinals, and I found myself very agitated, very upset. I was cranky. I was annoyed. Nothing was right. Everything was terrible. In the eighth inning, I stood up and I walked out onto the guideway, the walkway, and I looked out over the parking lot. And I saw the palm trees, and I saw the smog, and I saw Los Angeles, and I realized I was having a post-traumatic stress response. It was absolutely textbook. So I laughed at myself, went back in, and watched the rest of the game, but realized I still missed the Brooklyn Dodgers. Thanks very much.
My name is Mike Levine, and it's May 10th, 2014, and I also have a sports story. The story starts in the third week of November 1980 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And what do you think happens on the third Saturday in November? Yes, and guess who won? We did. So I'm going to be away New Year's Day, so I went out and bought one of those $800 newfangled things called a VCR, and I'm going to record the Rose Bowl because I'm going to be away with my family when the game was going to be on. Anyhow, I come back, and instead of getting the Rose Bowl, I got Mickey Mouse, and I said, oh God. Yeah, I mean, all this buildup, you know what I mean? Anyhow. So I said, there's got to be a better way. And so I thought about it, and I said, well, it programmed like a Casio watch. I don't know if you people know the Casio watch, where you hold the mode button down for 3 seconds and the split stopwatch comes on and whatnot. It's really impossible. So I said, we need something that'll prompt you what to do, like what day of the week do you want to record, what time, what channel, in English. And I said, displays in 1980 were outrageously expensive, so I shelved it for a while. Then I said, oh my God, what's attached to a VCR? TV set. What can you put on a TV set? Information, like numbers and letters and questions. Okay. What can I do for a keyboard? Well, what else is attached to a VCR? A remote. So I came up with the idea of asking a bunch of questions on a TV set and fill in the blanks and therefore be able to record what you want in plain English. And that became on-screen programming for the VCR. Every VCR has one, and they all took licenses, at least for the United States market. But while I was at it, I parenthetically thought of something else that was going on. I both had a house in Florida and I had a house in Michigan. And there was these newfangled things called cable channels that were just coming out, like ESPN. And I noticed that ESPN in Florida had a different channel than ESPN in Ann Arbor. And I said, oh my God, now I got to know what channel is ESPN on. And I said, oh God, this looks so awful. And I said, you know what would really be nice? This is in the patent, I said this. What would really be nice is if you could take the contents of the book, the TV guide, digitize it, put it in a local memory, Then you could go sort through the local memory and select an appropriate portion of what you want, like football, Michigan. People have them. And I said, we'll select an appropriate portion for view and future use. And that became the on-screen programming guide that everybody has with their those people who watch cable TV and have DVRs or even set-top boxes. And so the frustration of not getting a Michigan game resulted in one of the most universal used inventions here in the United States. 60 or 70 million are now in current use on a daily basis. So anyhow, I want to thank Bo Schembechler, who is my neighbor down the street, and especially for winning, because if he didn't win, I wouldn't be standing here. But okay, thank you very much. Bye.
My name is Ron Gregg. I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Today's date is May 10, 2014. As I've gotten older, I've come to realize that stories get layers put on them over the years. Some of the layers are not always happy. When I was in grade school and high school, I was a Boy Scout. I was not just a regular Boy Scout, but I was a Super Scout. I was not only an Eagle, but I went way beyond the Eagle rank. And I served on camp staffs for 4 or 5 years during my high school and college years. And during some of those years, the person who was our camp director, whose name was John Clairhout, organized trips for the staff to take out to either Philmont, which is a scout reservation in New Mexico, or to Yosemite. One of the years we went to Philmont, my father went along with me. He had been an Eagle Scout before me, and he painted this picture. And this is me and the famous burro, who you had to get the attention of to get over the stream. And we spent a couple of weeks up in the mountains at Philmont. And I learned a lot when I was in Boy Scouts. I had, 50 or 60 merit badges and all kinds of things. So I was really into Boy Scouts. And my son, who also went into Scouts, as I was a Scoutmaster at the time, he became an Eagle Scout also. But my son was gay. And when the Scouts had this issue about whether to allow gay Scouts and gay leaders, and they worried about that for a number of years. And even though he was an Eagle Scout, they sort of split the difference. So that was another layer on this story. And then the last layer on this story was that earlier this week, I learned that John Clairhout, who had been this leader and had become the chief executive of the Los Angeles District for the Boy Scouts of America, had died. And I thought, well, who can I send this to? I had no one to send it to, because my father had died. And I had to send it to a boy that I knew in high school who had gone with me out to Philmont when we were young. So this painting, though, brings it all back and makes it a happy memory for me. Because this, I can remember all the challenges that we had when we were boys and how we overcame everything. So, thank you.
Okay. My name is Susie Eyre, and I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Today is May 10th, 2014. The story I'm going to tell you is about this keychain, this doll, and a couple photo books that I brought along. I like to travel, and I'm currently reading the book, The Happiness Project, And one of the things that she talks about is how great it is to have a collection. And if you have a collection, that's one way to find happiness. Well, I've been collecting dolls since I was a little girl. And every trip that I take, and I've been to over 43 countries, I buy a doll. And people buy dolls for me if they go to a country where it's unlikely that I have been or I will ever get to. So a year ago December, I booked a trip with Overseas Adventure Travel to Morocco. And it was one of those places I book trips, I group trips when it's a place I don't think I can go on my own, and definitely Morocco qualified for that. I found out that to fly to Morocco, I had to stop in Paris and change planes. So I decided I would stay in Paris for a week first, and that I could do on my own. So I stayed in Paris, and one day when I was in front of the Louvre in the Tuileries Gardens, one of the vendors was selling these keychains. And I always bring back presents for just about everybody I know. So I bought about a dozen of these. And I put one on my backpack on the front. So then after my week in Paris, I flew on to Morocco, to Casablanca, and then I started my group tour. The adventure travel part of the trip is true to the name. One of the things that we did, and this is a photo book that I made of my trip, and it shows the cover is us riding camels in the desert. So about halfway through the trip, we had a two-night stay that were intense in the desert. And the tents were actually quite nice. They had beds, and there was actually a back section that had a toilet. So it was very comfortable. The guides, though, had a bit of trouble figuring out what to do with us for 2 days, because we're in the middle of the desert. There's not all that much to do. So one of the things that they did with us is we got up really early one morning, and we went to watch the sunset over the desert. Then, after breakfast, they took us on a hike through the desert, and this picture shows the hike, and I'll pass this around and people can take a closer look if they'd like. I don't really like to walk, and so I rode in the Jeep with the driver, and then we stopped because the other people were way ahead of us. And it was actually great because the driver found me two fossils. He was just standing around looking, and he found a fossilized bone and a fossilized turd, I believe. Anyway, so I got those souvenirs. We got to the Bedouin tents, which is what our destination was, and I've got my backpack, and we are sitting in the tent, and this woman, the mother of the group there, huge family, was weaving, and she showed us how she made the yarn from the camel hair. And I noticed she kept looking at my backpack, and she kept looking at my keychain. And I thought, when we were all done, she was done, we sat, we had mint tea with them, and I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna give this to her. I think she would like it. And she didn't speak English, I didn't speak Arabic, but we communicated anyways. So I gave her the keychain, and she smiled for me for this picture. I'm also a professional photographer, so I really like to do photo books. And then we all went outside, and on the ground, they had a lot of little souvenirs, leather camels, you know, toy camels, and little jewelry, very simple kind of items, nothing fancy. And I noticed this doll, and I started looking at this doll, and the woman came out, and she picked up the doll, and she gave it to me as a gift. So that was my personal encounter with, I don't know her name, but this beautiful woman who lives in the desert in Morocco.
My name is Sharon Newman. I'm in the main branch of the Ann Arbor District Library on May 10th, 2014. And I want to tell about experience I had almost 30 years ago as a volunteer in the Israeli Army. This was a program that had just recently been started. It was called Volunteers for Israel, where civilians, and now they come from all over the world, would go and actually do some of the work of Army reservists, so they wouldn't necessarily have to serve their whole time, because they had to go every year for a month, I believe. We lived on an Army base. We were near Afula in the northern part of Israel, and we lived in barracks. There were four women in a room. It was very rustic. The bathrooms, the shower was just a pipe coming down, and we would wash our clothes in the sink and hang them up in our rooms on clotheslines to dry. My job was, this base was dealing with tanks, and my job was in a warehouse where we were cleaning and storing spare parts for tanks, small things, maybe mostly computer elements. And so a couple other women would clean these parts and then give them to me. And this is a picture of me at work. I had a machine that I would suck I would put the part in a plastic bag, and I would suck the air out of it, and then I had a thing that I would seal it. And we worked Monday through Thursday and part of Friday, and then we had the weekends off. And most of the weekends I spent at cousins of mine in Tel Aviv, but the last week I was there, Chuck came up, and we stayed at the King David Hotel, which is my favorite hotel in the world. He gets annoyed when I say it was about the best thing I ever did, because forgetting my husband and children, but it was one of the best things I've ever done. I just felt good being there, not as a tourist, and being really useful. It was really something. When we first got there, we wore uniforms on the base, and they would just sent us to a room that just had boxes and all over the floor, shirts and pants and boots, and you just kept walking around trying one on until it fit, and that's what you took. We were not allowed to wear the uniforms off the base, which was a really good idea, but it was just wonderful. They were so happy to have us there. They really showed us a wonderful time. They would have classes. We had a banquet at the end, doing Israeli dancing, and it was just a really special experience. So I can pass this around if you want.
Hi, my name is Janet Ogelmeter, and I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and today is May 10th, 2014. I live out in Chelsea, and I'm sure all of you are familiar. Chelsea's a lovely town that's about 15, 20 minutes away from Ann Arbor. I moved to Chelsea about 10 years ago, and shortly after I moved there, I wanted to get involved with the Chelsea Area Historical Society. It's a lovely community, and right away I was attracted to all the architecture, and I just wanted to know the stories, because I guess I've been a closeted history buff all my life. At the time, I was working as a psychotherapist, and that's what I had been doing, but I loved history. And so I got involved, and one of the first projects that they gave to me was I didn't know the name of it then, but was a personal history project. It was to talk with a gentleman who used to be a Chelsea resident, but who had lived for the last 45 years out in California. And for 34 of those years, he was a Disney artist. And he had recently gotten in contact with the Chelsea Area Historical Society and donated just a wealth of beautiful personal Disney art. His name is Joe Hale, and he worked on Pete's Dragon. He'd sent us some images from Pete's Dragon. He'd also worked on Lady and the Tramp, Sleeping Beauty. I mean, many of the names that I grew up just, you know, watching these movies and thinking and being in awe, and here I was, you know, interviewing and learning about a gentleman who had actually worked on them and was an artist who drew some of those things. So I got to help with the display at the Historical Society, putting up a display. But then we decided, you know, this is too fantastic just to keep in our little museum. Let's do a bigger thing about it. So I wrote an article for the paper. And of course, all this meaning, I was talking to Joe all the while and taking, documenting his history. And once it was all done, I took a bunch of photographs and I sent him the clipping out of the newspaper as well. And he, about 3 weeks later in the mail, I opened up this from him. And it is by far the best thank you I've ever gotten from anybody. This is an original that he had done of Jock from Lady and the Tramp, because when we had talking one day on the phone, I did this all by phone, he recalled me saying that Lady and the Tramp was next to Winnie the Pooh, was my favorite Disney. And he had worked on Lady and the Tramp as one of the artists. So he had sent this to me as a thank you. And of course, I cherish it just because it is lovely and it's Disney. So it hangs up in my dining room. But even more so, as I thought about why I was bringing this today, it really got me started with personal history, which is what I'm doing now. And many of you know that is collecting the stories of others and writing and gathering those life stories because it's so important. And actually, I left the career as a psychotherapist, and for the last 2 years, I've been working as a personal historian, and I'm loving every minute of it, and I hope to keep finding interesting people like this to write about and capture those stories so they're not lost. That's my story.
I'm Chuck Newman. It's May 10th. We're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I'm telling you a little bit about my grandfather, Alex Katz, who was quite a character. And in this particular picture, you can see he's waving a fist at someone. That someone was me, because he wanted a great-grandchild. And I've always been slightly irreverent. So when he offered me $1,000, I asked him whether I had to be married at the time, and so I got the fist, only symbolically in this case. He, like many other of my relatives, came from Eastern Europe. In his case, it was Russia, where his family was a cap maker. And he, from what I can tell of the history, he had to leave Russia because, although his family was very religious, he was a socialist, which you can take as communist. And he had been active in the socialist activities. In fact, although I'm not sure it was related to that, at one point the Cossacks were raiding his little shtetl, and his father took a swipe of a sword that was intended for him, and I understand his father always had that scar on his arm. But word came that the Tsar's police were looking for my grandfather, and that was the reason he immigrated to America. Now, a number of years late, many, many years later, because I had been born, Sharon and I went to the Soviet Union. But before we went, one of my relatives in Chicago said, you know you have relatives still in Russia, in the Soviet Union. I was not aware of that. But through them, we found a distant cousin in Stockholm, Sweden, who had been in touch with the Russian relatives. And we had the opportunity to visit them and hear the story. And it turns out that my grandfather's aunt married a man, and they were living, I believe, in Finland at the time. And they were active in the local communist cell there. And there's supposed to be a picture somewhere of that cell taken with the visitor Lenin, who was on his way back from France to start the 1918 revolution. And again, the family story is that big black coat that he would wear was given to him by my grandfather's aunt and uncle. My grandfather's aunt's husband subsequently became, I think, an assistant ambassador in Washington. He was the governor of one of the Far East republics for Russia. And we visited our distant relatives. I believe it was the grandson of my grandfather's aunt and uncle in their Moscow apartment when we were there. And this is when it was still the USSR. They made it was very clear to us that they were no longer Jewish. And although their English wasn't good, they were able to convey to us the fact that they weren't the men weren't circumcised, which was good to know, I guess. Didn't have any practical value. And it turns out that the family, this grandson of my aunt, my grandfather's aunt and uncle, was a children's book writer, very famous, and he was there with his wife and children and another child by his mistress, which I thought was interesting. And we had it was a great time. And then when we got back home, we were corresponding. And in fact, before we went, they said, we asked them, what would you like us to bring? And they asked us to bring syringes, because at that point in the Soviet Union, that when you took your child, whenever you went to be have some sort of inoculation, they would reuse the syringes, and thereby they were passing along all sorts of communicable diseases and the like. So we didn't know why they wanted them, but nobody stopped us at Russian customs, fortunately. And subsequently, his grandson, the fellow we were talking about just now, came and he spent a year studying geology here at the University of Michigan. But we sent them money, we sent them things, but we haven't heard from them in many, many years.
My name is Ira Lax, and I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the Ann Arbor District Library. And today's date is May 10th, 2014. I brought a decoy here to show you. This is in tribute to a wonderful man that myself and three other friends met back about 10, 15 years ago in Fond du Lac County, Wisconsin. The four of us took a five-day trip every spring to learn about ancient America in the Midwest. We had been down to Cahokia, which is just north of St. Louis, which is one of the great ancient sites. The Mississippian peoples developed that site and lived there over about a 200-year period from about 1000 to 1200 AD, and then they dispersed. But during that time period, it was the greatest trading center in North America, and they found materials from all over North America at that site. And so people from all over came there. And so once we saw that, then we wanted to go to all kinds of other satellite sites. Once people moved out of there, they moved to various sites through the Midwest. And somewhere in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, not too many in Michigan, strange to say, or at least they haven't discovered them. But anyway, one of the great people we met in Fond du Lac County was a farmer named Bob Krug. And when he retired from dairy farming, he took his grandsons up in the hills where the cows usually didn't go and disturbing the land. And he did some burn-offs and found some very interesting stone circles and other geometric stone formations on the ground. And he let some archaeologists from Marquette University in Milwaukee know about it. And they came and authenticated some of these sites as being from ancient peoples. And he let some of the Potawatomi Indians in that area know. And also Cheyenne had actually been from that area before they moved out on the plains as nomadic horse riding people. So Bob was also a folk artist. And he could carve anything out of wood, and he loved carved birds. And so all four of us, after Bob would take us on a tour of his land and show us his latest sites, we went there over several years. And he became one of our really, truly best friends, people we loved and very much. So we all collected as many of these. He sold them for almost nothing. So we all have great collections of canes and birds and branches. And so our houses are filled with these things. And so The four of us did this every spring for about 5 days, for about 10 years, and just want to say how much we love that time, and this this little duck is one of many things that a wonderful man named Bob Krug created.
Thank you.
He passed away about 4 years ago, and just before that happened, we made our last trip to his farm, and we went to see the site with a big circle, kind of like this, but the land went up like this, and it was down onto, so you could imagine people in there moving around, dancing, praying, whatever, for days, and then the Potawatomi people who were there that day doing a ceremony, invited us to join in, and they honored Bob by allowing him to dance around the middle of the circle, and that happened to be our last time with him, and then he died not long after that. So it was a great sign of respect for him, and then he arranged for the land to be sold to them. So now the Potawatomi people of that part of Wisconsin own and use that land, which probably was a holy site to many people of that area. We're not sure which tribes, but Cheyenne was definitely part of that. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm Stephanie Cadle Terrace. I'm here in Ann Arbor on May 10th, 2014, and I'm here to tell you a story actually about my hometown in Elkins, West Virginia, which is where I grew up, a small town of about 6,000 people in the Appalachian Mountains. And I bring this because about 10 years ago, I was back visiting, and I went into an antique store in the downtown and found this banner, and I absolutely had to purchase it because it represents for me a couple of important milestones in my life, and I've had it up on the wall in my office ever since I found it. So when I interview people about their life stories for my work, we often sort of organize the storytelling around milestones. And so the stories that I have about this come both from being a young child and from being an adolescent. You can see it says Central School, and it says 1914 to 1976. Now, in 1975 to 76, I was in second grade, and I was at Central School. That's the only year that I spent at Central School because after that they closed. Now, I wasn't there in the year before. I was in a kindergarten. And then you might wonder, well, what happened to first grade? Well, what happened was I went to first grade, and after about a month, the teacher decided that I already knew everything that you needed to know for first grade, and she was just having me help all the other kids in class, and so she and my parents sort of got together and figured out that they ought to just send me on to second grade. And I would have to say that that really was sort of an identity-changing experience for me, because first of all, I think it made me think the rules don't apply to me, which I've pretty much followed the rest of my life. And the other reason was because it made me think that I was smart, which I'm not totally sure is true, but if you're young and people tell you that you, you know, are more exceptional, then you kind of carry that throughout your life. And so I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, moving on to second grade really had a great impact on how I thought about myself. It also made me younger than all my classmates for the rest of my education, which had an effect because, you know, you compare your ages a lot when you're kids. And I was also always short, so I was especially small moving up into the next elementary grades. I also remember that I turned up, you know, about a month into second grade not knowing all the second grade stuff. And I remember I was like writing on lined paper for the first time. We had never had lined paper before in kindergarten. And another girl had to like show me where to write your name on the line and then not to write below the last line because I was just continuing on down in the margin, you know. So I still remember, you know, things that I had to just figure out. So the story jumps forward then about 8 or 9 years when I was in high school. And by then, Central School, which had closed in 1976, it was no longer a public school after that, had been bought by some local developer and turned into apartments. So it was like a downtown old three-story brick apartment building. And as it turns out, my boyfriend's family lived in one of those apartments. And I decided that this was the boyfriend that I was going to lose my virginity to. So the fact is that the first time I had sex was in the same building where I went to second grade. So you can see why when I saw this banner, I figured I better buy it and keep it as a memento. So that's my story.